very timely and interesting talk. As you can see, diagramming the nation's socioeconomic class differences in language in two secondary schools by Professor Elizabeth Peacock. Professor Peacock is Assistant Professor of Cultural and Linguistic Anthropology at University of Wisconsin La Crosse. She originally received her BA from University of Kansas and an MA and PhD from the University of California, San Diego. We're happy to have her back in Wisconsin with us. Her research examines issues of community and belonging as they relate to young people, sociolinguistics, and global migration. She's currently working on articles dealing with morality and with Odessa's Living Dolls, which you can tell us about at some point, maybe in Q&A, and prescriptive speech on bus posters. Her future projects include a comparison of youth in Lviv, Ukraine, and the Ukrainian-American community in Chicago, and the use of digital forms of communication by Ukrainian migrants, all extremely timely. And she will continue her longitudinal study, Emerging from the Second World, Class, Language, and Migration Among the First Generation of Post-Socialism, this summer with the support of an IREX Individual Advanced Research Grant. So please join me in welcoming Professor Peacock.
Okay, so bear with me. Most of that introduction was written a little while ago, so some things have changed, but all the basics are there. All the basics are there. So what I'm going to be presenting today is an article that I'm going to be sending out in terms of language use, language learning, and a lot of the and Western Ukrainian teenagers thinking about what does it mean to speak Ukrainian, what counts as Ukrainian, right? What counts as Ukrainian speaker? And I want to sort of make some connections that are scalar, that are looking at not just the local, but how the local and the national and the global sort of intertwine with each other, as well as how the past and what we want for the future comes into play, as well as people's social relations. So we'll probably end a little early to talk about some of the recent issues the recent events in Ukraine and how maybe some of these things we can talk about, like at least the younger generation, this first generation of post-socialism in Lviv in Western Ukraine. So start in the anthropological sense. While on a field trip with ninth graders in Lviv, a city in Western Ukraine, the students had become bored and dissatisfied with the driver's radio selection. A few students had asked the chaperoning teachers if they could use the bus speaker system to play some of their music. At first, the teenager suggested they have a sing-along instead, asking a couple of girls who sang well to use the bus driver's microphone and lead the group in singing some traditional Ukrainian songs. The girls sang a few, but few of the other students joined in. After the sing-along, some of the students asked if they could play songs from their cell phones, putting their phones up to the microphone. The teachers agreed as long as the songs were, quote, good, and, quote, in Ukrainian. In short order, these rules were broken. The music choices began with Ukrainian language standards, then contemporary Ukrainian rock. One girl, Nina, then asked if she could play one of her songs. One of the teachers asked, quote, is it good? To which Nina responded, well, it's in Ukrainian. The song was a popular hip-hop song performed in Ukrainian, but one unlikely to be considered good by the teachers. Receiving no ill response from the supervising teachers, a few Russian language songs of a similar type were played, and then an English language hip-hop rap song. In the middle of the song, the teacher said, that's enough, telling the students to turn it off and repeating that they wanted something good. So the kids played songs, mostly Russian pop songs or hip-hop. After a few more songs, the teachers complained of the loud volume and they ended the cell phone jukebox. The teachers tried for another sing-along, but few participated. The bus radio was finally turned to a Russian language radio station playing older Russian songs. It is in instances such as these that the ideologies of what counts as good language come to the forefront, highlighting how such language ideologies are contextually mediated, not only by the local interaction, but also wider national and global environments. In playing their music, these youth quickly moved through multi-layered scales, from the Ukrainian-only local, to the Ukrainian-Russian bilingual national, to the English-dominated global, in their acts of engaging as members of a wider culture of hip-hop. Although Lviv and much of the western regions of Ukraine see the Ukrainian language as central to national identity and self-determination, in everyday life, young people engage with language ideologies from various sources, dried upon them as they move through different spheres, from the classroom to their local social networks to the global arena of popular youth culture. In this presentation, I seek to show how young people's meta-discourses about the proper way to learn and speak Ukrainian and foreign languages are complex and ambivalent. Their attitudes towards dialects of Ukrainian and formalized language instruction respond to the local and national ideologies of language acquisition and competency they find at school, as well as those they learn through their socioeconomic class ties. Ideologies about proper speech also involve wider issues of citizenship, migration, and modernity, especially for these students. Drawing from world systems theory and social geography, recent literature in the linguistic anthropology of education has focused on challenging micro-macro dichotomies of space, time, and relation in order to better theorize how people's linguistic practices help them engage in their social worlds. As Bloomer argues, quote, human social environments need to be seen as polycentric and stratified, where people continuously need to observe norms that are attached to a multitude of centers of authority, local as well as transnational, monetary as well as lasting. A recent issue of Anthropology in Education Quarterly explored scale in educational context, from identity making in undergraduate science labs to understanding the pedagogy behind monastic debates. As these scholars show, scale is essential to understanding how social reproduction occurs through macro institutions like schooling, as well as through micro interactions that occur within classrooms. Scholars of youth have shown how young people engage with wider social phenomenon, such as those that reproduce class identities or constrain economic opportunities. As sites of social reproduction, schools are often places where social norms and identities are learned or challenged. For many minority nations, schooling has become a tool for legitimizing the nation's language as a valuable basis for potential national sovereignty. For example, many post-socialist nation-building processes focused on building national sentiments in the youngest generation by reforming textbooks and promoting the national language, even if these reforms devalued local identities in the process. Youth can take an agentive role in affirming, rejecting, or challenging these national goals, however, such as when they support local dialects against national policies of standardization, or when they embrace wide-scale social movements. Rather than viewing children as mere vessels for society, those like Buchholz have highlighted how the cultural practices of young people can be a valid object of study in itself. So, I'm sure you guys know already, right, that right there, that's Lviv, that's where I did my research. I first went there in 2003, was also there during the Orange Revolution, did my primary research for about a year and a half in 2006, 2007, went back last summer. I have funding for my ARICS. We've kind of agreed that it would be good for me to postpone it, so I'm hoping to use that funding to go next summer to be able to follow up with these kids that are now ages 20 to 22. So, in Ukraine, national discourses promote Ukrainian as the sole official language in which in theory, all Ukrainians should eventually know, whether it is because it is their, quote, mother tongue, or as ethnic Ukrainians, or because they are citizens of Ukraine. While Western regions of Ukraine are seen as the most ardent in linking language and national identity, what counts as Ukrainian in places like Lviv is not as clear-cut as these ideologies suggest. Rather, people's attitudes are shaped in part by their experiences with regional varieties and the people who speak them. Local ideologies in Lviv reinforce national ideologies of linguistic purity, the avoidance of mixing languages in one speech. This avoidance extends from the stigmatized practice of surzhik, where the lexical items, syntactic structures, and phonology of Ukrainian and Russian are combined within a single utterance, to more common linguistic practices such as code switching. These notions of purity often result in what Lada Belaniuk has called non-reciprocal bilingualism, where one speaker speaks Ukrainian, the other Russian, with both understanding the other's language, but neither switches the languages for accommodation. One local ideology not shared elsewhere in the country, however, is the idea that language is a reflection of one's ethnic identity. In short, a Russian-speaking person in Lviv is often thought to claim a Russian identity, or you're a foreign scholar. In practice, these ideologies of ethno-linguistic identity and purism mask the difference economic class plays in young people's understandings of what counts as a valid Ukrainian speech, and the wider ways in which different linguistic varieties can create social capital. I examine the intersection between classroom practices and students' own ideas about language learning in order to demonstrate how teenagers of different social classes view the value of Ukrainian dialects, formalized language instruction, and foreign languages more broadly. The ultimate goal of both Mrs. Stadnik and Mr. Tranko, Ukrainian language teachers at the working class Taras Shevchenko and the middle class Ivan Franko public secondary schools, respectively, is for their students to master standard Ukrainian. While both teachers teach the same material, often using identical textbooks, the different strategies they use in their classrooms help shape their students' ideologies about language. Lessons in Ukrainian language at both schools are often centered on testing students' verbal and literacy skills with the use of rote memorization, dictation, and public performance. Classroom practices included having students write out dictated sentences in their notebooks or on the front chalkboard. In a typical practice used at both schools, the teacher would call on a student and dictate a sentence for the student to write on the front chalkboard. The student would diagram the sentence according to the day's grammatical focus. After the student was finished, the teacher would explain the student's work to the rest of the class. Students at both schools were expected to complete the same work in their own notebooks, following along with the student in the front of the classroom. And these notebooks were sort of as artifacts of your learning that the teacher later on would collect, go through, see what problems you had in there, etc. But oftentimes it was a formality. The goal was to have everything be correct in your notebook in some of these cases. Another practice used less frequently required students to read written work aloud. Easy way to grade compositions, you write it at home, the teacher calls on you, and she grades you on your public oral performance of your essay. This included reading from the textbook, but also teachers' evaluations of students' compositions based on their oral performances of written work. These pedagogical practices achieved two goals. First, they link writing to speech, implying that a student's literacy skills are reflective to some degree of their speech and vice versa. Second, they emphasize the public nature of language, showing that one's speech is always at risk of being evaluated by others. While both schools promoted Ukrainian as a central feature of Ukrainian national identity and of the local Lvivian identity, the variation in how teachers enacted these practices resulted in different notions of who might be able to master Ukrainian, and how linguistic mastery was to be achieved, and which ways of speaking Ukrainian were to be valued. Okay, I'm gonna put this one up now. During Mrs. Stadnik's lessons at the working class Taras Shevchenko Secondary School, board work is a way for top students to publicly demonstrate their knowledge and expertise of the material, acting as models for weaker students to emulate. Mrs. Stadnik primarily selects high-achieving students to complete the exercises at the front board, who do so quickly and easily. Since Mrs. Stadnik expects students' notebooks to be neat, tidy, and with no errors, the other students often wait to write in their notebooks until the student at the board has finished. These classroom practices imply that the mastery of Ukrainian is a skill that comes easily, but only for some people. While high-achieving students are always expected to display their mastery, being called to the front on a daily basis, and often completing several exercises while there, low-achieving ones are rarely asked to do so. When they work at the front chalkboard, their inadequacies are often emphasized. The low-achieving student seeks out the help of classmates, and often gets scolded for not already having mastered the material. The resulting impression of these chalkboard exercises is that they are simple and easy tasks to do, which leaves little room for other students to ask questions about the exercise or why a particular answer is correct. The idea that only some people can master the ideal literary Ukrainian is evident in the attitudes of Mrs. Stadnik's students. Though they value the language they learn at school, they also recognize that it departs heavily from working class people's everyday language uses. Mr. Petrenko at the middle class Ivan Franko, chalkboard time is a time for mistakes to be made and corrected. In contrast to Ms. Stadnik, Mr. Petrenko focuses on improving the skills of the weaker students. When high-achieving students raise their hand to go to the blackboard, Mr. Petrenko often refuses them, saying, quote, "I know that you know how to do this." implying that working at the blackboard is a way to show one's capability. Once a student has proven her ability to do the work, she no longer needs to do board work. Although the student at the front might not know all of the answers, eliciting the help of other students and the teacher, he is expected to do all of the written work at the blackboard. For Mr. Petrenko, students learn how to do the exercises correctly through their time at the blackboard and with the help of other students. Unlike Mrs. Studnick, he does not expect students to effortlessly complete the exercises. If they have mastered the material, there is no longer a need for them to be at the blackboard. In a way, working at the board teaches Mr. Petrenko's students that mastering Ukrainian is not a simple process or an innate skill. Rather, language learning is a process which develops over time and through practice and dedicated work. Furthermore, everyone has an obligation as Ukrainians to learn to speak the standard Ukrainian, a perspective that is echoed in the values and attitudes of the middle-class youth at Mr. Petrenko's school. The differences between these teaching practices suggest differing interpretations of language learning. Though each teacher may have been performing as much, or more so for me, the researcher, than for their students, their classroom practices represent their views on the relation between teachers and students in the process of learning. Mrs. Studnick's lessons emphasize the demonstration of multiple skills correctly, quickly, simultaneously, and without help. Little time is spent correcting mistakes or explaining the nuances of correct answers, implying that language and using standard Ukrainian is easy and simple. Linguistic purity, therefore, should also be easy and simple to achieve. Since the majority of work is done by a few high-achieving students, however, few are ever shown as mastering the language to this degree. Other students are rarely called to the blackboard, and help from other students is often unneeded and interpreted as a form of classroom disruption. As a result, those who fail to be linguistically fluent and standard in the writing of Ukrainian are erased from this interaction. In contrast, Mr. Petrenko's students are expected to learn from their mistakes and from each other. The implication here is that a good command of standard written Ukrainian does not come naturally, but requires practice and involves mistakes. With time, everyone can improve and achieve written linguistic purity. These perspectives of language learning, that of exclusive, complex, and error-free use shown at Taras Shevchenko, and that of inclusive, practical mistakes to be corrected at Ivan Franko, are also reflected in the teaching of foreign languages and students' orientations towards learning other languages. The classroom is a site of exclusive linguistic purity at Taras Shevchenko. At Ivan Franko, languages are practical skills that anyone can require, Youth at both schools voiced the belief that speaking Ukrainian was an essential element of claiming a Ukrainian identity, and that one shouldn't mix languages when they speak. In practice, however, the teenagers differed as to what forms of Ukrainian were valid ways of speaking Ukrainian, and how one learned to speak. These differences reflect both the ideologies of the classroom, as well as their own expectations in terms of how language might be a useful tool for creating social capital in the future. In a discussion on language, Mrs. Studnick's students agreed that they learn much of their non-standard forms from their peers at school, and only secondly from television shows and action films imported from the United States. As one boy said, quote, "When I came to school, I didn't know any." But he quickly learned these words from his classmates. Though some claim to speak slang, quote, "all the time," others limit their uses. Not at home, not on the street, only at school. Youth slang at school provides students with a form of privacy, as Soya explained, quote, "They, the teachers, don't understand this private youth language. We need to say something for our own satisfaction. Basically, we need to have a way of talking amongst ourselves that the teachers can't understand." For these typical teenagers, youth slang is used as a way of creating cohesion among classmates and create a space at school separate from adults. Though they uphold the idea of linguistic purity and claim that slang and vulgar speech should be avoided, for these working-class teenagers, non-standard Ukrainian, peppered with rural dialectal forms, Russian and Surzhik, was also a fact of life. They do not take their use of non-standard speech as a character flaw, neither viewing it as a liability for future job opportunities nor romantic relationships. In a group activity that I facilitated, which centered on creating word lists of slang and other cool words, these teenagers seemed eager to use non-standard forms in the school's cafeteria. Despite the scolding of a nearby lunch lady, these youth used vulgarisms, asked questions about English words that they had heard, and otherwise presented their speech as, quote, "how we usually talk." This valuing of stigmatized forms as a way of creating a unique youth identity was not found among the middle-class teenagers in Mr. Petrenko's class at Ivan Frankl. They acknowledge that Ukrainian has different dialects. Even Lvivians like them have a way of speaking that is distinct from other regions. However, their discussion of dialects focused implicitly on rural speech practices, which they describe as, quote, not pretty, and, quote, not cool. They also conceptually link rural Surzhik speech to slang and vulgarities, all as sort of like this one hodgepodge of things you shouldn't be doing. These middle-class teenagers admit that young people like them speak cool, and they use both Russian slang and vulgarisms, but that these practices are bad and ugly and they shouldn't be doing it. For them, using Russian slang is a habit, but one that is not necessary. Ukrainian may have some of its own slang, but the slang and vulgar speech forms they use aren't needed. For the middle class, people should speak only the standard. These teenagers' uses of Russian slang, then, and vulgarities can be seen as a compromise with their larger ideas of purism. For them to be both a cool young person and a Ukrainian speaker who's committed to upholding ideologies of linguistic purity, they choose to borrow slang and vulgarisms from foreign languages, like Russian and English. While middle-class students at Ivan Frankl admit to using some non-standard forms, they place a high value on urban Ukrainian and show more of a concern with how others would view their uses of other forms than their working-class counterparts. They similarly have no problem speaking slang with their classmates. However, one should never use it because of others' judgment. As Ksenia described it, quote, among girls in our own groups, we can talk like that. But around boys, they notice, like, if you're going to speak like that, boys don't understand this. They don't. How girls have to be, right? How girls have to watch their speech a little bit more. And then later on, she says, boys don't like girls who speak slang, who speak this way. Ksenia frames the use of non-standard forms as a threat to a person's public face, especially for young women considering how potential romantic partners might perceive them. An oft-quoted adage in Lviv was that, quote, the more languages one speaks, the more of a person one becomes. Teachers at both schools saw multilingualism as a valuable educational goal, and some students echoed the sentiment. But while both schools required students to have lessons in at least one foreign language, English, the students, however, were differently expected to be able to speak the language. The students at both schools also differed in how they viewed the process of learning a language. Just as they learned youth slang and many vulgarities from their peers at school, the working-class teenagers often saw languages as learned through one's exposure to the language, rather than limiting it to formal instruction. Their incorporation of dialect forms reflect these youth's firsthand experiences with rural village life and language practices, as many of them regularly visit village relatives and spend the entire summer there. This notion of learning by living was also expressed in terms of foreign languages. Though Mrs. Stadnik's students had both English and German lessons, for many of them these subjects had little practical value. Rather, many of them claimed to be able to get by in a more useful language, Russian. From Russian language media, such as cheap and easy access to Russian translations of popular foreign fiction and Russian medium online gaming and social networking like the Kontakti, these teens felt confident in navigating those foreign languages as they interacted with them in everyday life. Despite never having been taught Russian, many knew that it was a language that would be useful to know in the future. In contrast, middle-class teens in Mr. Petrenko's class value formal instruction. As Vika stated, quote, it's best to speak the kind of language you're taught in school without any of those dialects. By emphasizing taught language, the school is framed as the most appropriate site for language learning rather than a home environment. In addition to school lessons, several of these teenagers also had private English lessons and were less hesitant to practice their English with me. Granted, the students at Ivan Frankl were more able to pay for tutoring than those in the working class school, and they received higher quality education in instruction in English. So they didn't use much English on either side, but the English teachers at Ivan Frankl would often talk English with me. They wanted to practice English with me. They would do supplementary sort of things on their own, where at the working class school, the teachers were very hesitant to even invite me into their classes. They had this sort of sense that maybe their English wouldn't be good enough for a native speaker to watch them. This focus on formal instruction was also shared by the teachers at Ivan Frankl as well, who chose to take lessons to learn Italian, Greek, and Spanish, though foreign language texts and dictionaries were easy to obtain for at-home self-study. And I knew a lot of friends who said, I'm going to travel to Italy, I'm going to pick up a phrase book, I'm going to kind of learn a little bit on my own without having to pay for tutoring. The national and local level ideologies of language, as reflected in classroom practices and teenagers' views of language use, are linked to wider global values of multilingualism and the value of specific global languages, primarily Russian and English. While teenagers at both schools assert that multilingualism is essential to their students' futures, the national and local curriculum does not fully support this in practice. Students are taught foreign languages as early as first grade in the public schooling system, but people rarely claim fluency without additional study, whether on their own or through formal instruction. Oftentimes, this ends up being maybe half an hour starting in the first grade. By the time they're in high school, it might be 2 hours a week, 3 hours a week. Even when I went back and saw students this summer, like none of them really could say that I had all those years of English, but they didn't feel like they could actually speak any of it, except for the ones who had private studies or were taking it in college. In discussions about Ukrainians working abroad and migration more broadly, working class kids felt that English might be a useful language, but that it was better to, quote, wait and see where you end up. As many of them knew adults who had immigrated to various parts of Europe, many of these teenagers challenged the idea that English, as a global language, would be useful for them as migrants. Migration for the working class was more of a last resort to make ends meet, rather than a chosen path, especially since many find themselves as part of an abused, undocumented underclass in places like Italy and Spain. Mastering a foreign language, then, for these working class kids, therefore, was a way of giving up, acknowledging that one had no future in Ukraine, something on par with abandoning your country, your language, and your culture. For them, Russian is similar enough to Ukrainian that it can be easily acquired without formal study. The threat to the Ukrainian language does not come from the Russian-speaking community in Ukraine, but rather from those Ukrainians living in other countries who stop speaking the language and fail to transmit it to the next generation. The situation was different, though, for those of the middle class, whose migration discourse is centered on studying abroad at European institutions, traveling in order to see the world. For these teenagers, knowing an international language like English was thought to be a necessity, as, quote, people know and learn it in every country. However, these middle-class teens vocally expressed an anxiety that Ukrainian will disappear in Ukraine without concerted effort at its promotion and protection. This anxiety reflects a perspective that global Russian competes with and will eventually destroy Ukrainian within the borders of Ukraine. The alternative perspectives of language learning, though both linked to mastering standard language through formalized institutional setting, reflect different notions of language use and identity as speakers of Ukrainian. The exclusivity of the working classes school's approach in emphasizing the rarity of full command of the standard at the same time as it attempts to present it as simple and easy to do gives weaker students a reason for their lack of skills. This both reaffirms the social hierarchy of the language, in which only the elite and privileged can properly speak the standard, and the lower classes and those living in villages are left with their non-standard dialects and mixed Surzhik speech. Paradoxically, if becoming competent in the standard requires absolute purity, and it is simple and easy for only a select few to do, then the non-standard speech of the masses remains legitimate in its own way, as a marker of authentic ethnicity. As language plays a central role in Ukrainian identity, any language that does not come naturally cannot be a true reflection of the speaker. This same idea of language is linked to a person's core identity, is also present in the approach to language learning at Ivan Frankl, however, in a much different way. The acknowledgement of students' weaknesses is not equated to an inability to master the standard. Rather, every speaker has linguistic weaknesses that can be overcome. Though this perspective makes room for non-standard use throughout the learning process, in the end, it reaffirms the standard as the most legitimate way to speak Ukrainian. Though through this lens, the standard should be the goal of all Ukrainian speakers because it is their true native language. Non-standard dialects, though, are all interpreted as Surjic, the result of centuries of foreign rule. For working-class youth, rural dialects are valued for their concrete connection to particular places and to the values embodied in these places. Through classroom activities, their teachers promote the idea that linguistic mastery is an exclusive skill. Standardized language then becomes emblematic of an elite rather than the average person. With limited economic possibilities at home and abroad, and seeing how little proper speech and literacy skills matter for working class jobs, these teenagers also value learning languages through informal means. In short, working class youth link language to different kinds of personhood, with non-standard forms as organically learned markers of an authentic identity of authentic people. These working class teenagers embrace a wider variety of authentic ways of speaking Ukrainian and do not see the incorporation of other languages into their speech practices as a threat to their Ukrainian. Since mastery of standard Ukrainian is only within the reach of a few, the acceptance of linguistic variation legitimizes the speech of non-standard and rural dialect speakers. Extending this idea of exclusive linguistic mastery, these teenagers are equally accepting of their own informal acquisition and non-standard uses of Russian and other languages. However, this group also voiced the fear that when Ukrainians move abroad, they are at risk of losing their ethnic identity. By speaking other languages, they might no longer be Ukrainian. In contrast to their working class peers, middle class teenagers viewed standardized languages as essential to achieving global social mobility. Their lack of rural ties reflects their devaluing of rural dialects. While their teachers also promote linguistic mastery, classroom practices suggest that everyone can and should learn standardized Ukrainian in order to be a responsible citizen. The inclusivity of the standard is reflected in these youth's view that formalized education is the best way to learn any language. With more opportunities, both in Ukraine and globally, these teenagers focus on the value of learning to properly speak global languages. At Ivan Frankl, teenagers learn that standard Ukrainian can be achieved by anyone with hard work and dedication, resulting in their devaluation of non-standard speech and non-rural dialects, which are linked to uneducated speakers. This emphasis on inclusive linguistic mastery, however, influences their views of learning foreign languages. For this group to really know a language, they must be formally taught the literary standard. The Russian language's threat to Ukrainian lies not only in people's uses of the language on the street or in the media, but in the systematic, formalized instruction of Russian, which would come about if the language was given the status as a state language. However, there lies the possibility for Ukrainian speakers to retain their identity even if they live abroad. Just because they've learned a global language does not mean they have given up their Ukrainian identity. In short, this has potential repercussions for non-Ukrainian speakers in Ukraine, for rural non-standard speakers, and Ukrainian migrants living outside the country. Who then can claim to be Ukrainian? Can language continue to be essential for identity claims in Lviv? At heart, we are social beings, reacting and responding to not simply those things most prominent in our immediate environment, but also to those issues and concerns that came before this present, and that we anticipate we will be in our future. In the process of interpreting and testing what counted as good music that was in Ukrainian on the field trip bus ride from the anecdote we began with, these young people were navigating the overlapping and complex webs of their local relations as friends and students, the local ideologies of language that prioritize linguistic purity and literary Ukrainian, the national bilingual culture and its linguistic practices, as well as transnational spheres of popular culture and youthful self-expression. In examining young people as active agents in the creation and interpretation of what is the nation, an eye must be given to these other timescales, these other spatial levels, and how time and space are entwined in everyday social relations. Okay, so what I'm doing for future research is this summer I'm going to see how the feasibility is to look at some of these language issues among the Ukrainian-American community in Chicago. Specifically, I want to look at the same generation, the kids that were born after independent Ukraine, and see how much does language fit into that being Ukrainian. What does it mean for them to be Ukrainian? It doesn't mean voting. There's so many different things that are in there. And then hopefully I can bring on my IRIX, convince them another summer to follow up with the participants in Lviv so that I can do more formal research than I did last summer. And final acknowledgments, references, if you guys want any of the other references from the paper, that's fine. But that's about it. So questions, comments?
We'll let you
build
your own questions unless it gets out of
hand. We'll get out. Yeah, go ahead.
Is the prescriptively correct Ukraine used in television, or do they mostly watch television in Russian, English with like Ukrainian subtitles? Like, how is the media used?
Last time I was there, unless it's changed, it's a whole hodgepodge of things. So you've got channels that are all Ukrainian. You have channels that certain shows will be imported from Russia and then subtitled in Ukrainian. You have imported places from South America dramas, Turkish dramas, or Israeli, you know, American, where you can hear the original language underneath the dubbing, right? You have cable channels too, so you can watch news from Germany. I mean, there's so many different things that are options that maybe the working class might not have access to certain kinds, but the middle class might have access to others. But when it comes to the literary language, people don't necessarily talk that way. So what you get are promotions of Ukrainian classic film cinema that's all historic, right? That focuses on these big historic, big name people, just like the literature class was all centered in late 1800. Their textbook goes up to more recent things, but all of it is focused on like this pure, like literary sort of way of speaking. And a lot of it comes down to aesthetics. So even with the performance of like the student's essay, the teacher might say, "That's great, you get an 11 out of 12. And really there's no content there, but it sounds good, and the way that the student put the words together reflects this sort of like literary prettiness that the teacher was trying to promote.
So thanks for a very rich description of the differences between the two schools in terms of the instruction styles, in terms of how the students perceive the languages, their longitudes. But what a skeptic of this kind of approach would say is, okay, so you told us about two different schools and you're labeling this middle class versus working class, but how do we know that these aren't just two schools? It has nothing to do with the class differences. And one way you could answer that is to say, well, actually, there's, you know, if we think about the life conditions of the middle class in Lviv and the working class in Lviv, then there's a certain logic to why the middle class students would feel this way, why the middle class teachers would teach this way versus the working class. And I didn't hear you discuss that really. So, because you share your thoughts, like what is particularly middle class, or why should I think that this is a middle class approach versus a working class approach?
I think part of it was, so the way I came to, because even talking about class is really like a big gray, messy area to talk about in this region, was I wanted neighborhood schools that were public, so I didn't want to look at the elites who had a lot of money to send their kids to the private schools. And then I consulted with colleagues at Ivan Franko that asked me what are some schools that might be amenable to this. So when it came to the working class one, I defined that on basis of the region it was in the city, parents' educational levels, whether the parents were working in what they studied, whether how often they were unemployed, that kind of thing. I also looked at where they were born, in terms of a lot of them in the working class neighborhood, their parents were born in village areas and moved, so they were more recent to the city. And when it looked to the middle class, it was a different region that had a lot of these coalitions, more college education, they had more travel. I also looked at travel and where the kids were able to travel, had ever been to, and the parents had ever been to sort of figure out and say, what does class kind of look like? And so the one that was located that I'm marking as working class was set up by the education department saying, this is a good place for you to study, right? So they sort of helped guide me to what they thought was an ideal kind of school. And part of it, and also then they said, this is the teacher we think you should be studying with, right? That you should be observing. This is the ideal kind of teacher. And she had a lot of her practices were not necessarily unusual in terms of like the educational, the tradition of education in Ukraine. And also too, is she was also one of the model teachers that the students at the teaching college would go to and do practicums with. At the other school, that was where I had host families, much more middle class, their approach towards education, and part of it might have been their location towards the center, was they actually had a lot more exposure to having people come in and do research. Their relationship with their students were a little bit different. And the sense that I got was that these were reflective of sort of this, the ones who are still holding on to a little bit of a system at some way for order, and another one that was trying to move. So the working class was like, let me show you our best. And the middle class was like, let me show you all the problems I have to deal with. Right? These are reforms in how they're happening, right? And so I think that looking regionally in some of these other factors, it gives me a sense that they are representative of other schools that are like them, that they're not some kind of unique special school that was created for some particular kind of reason or another. I don't know if that...
Well, sure. So now, yes, I'm sort of convinced that you could characterize the one school's middle class and working class.
But of course, within the classes, I did have some working class kids at Ivan Frankl, and a lot of those kids echoed some of the things I heard at the school that was more predominantly working class. And I had a couple kids that you could characterize as middle class in Taras Shevchenko, who echoed some of the things that the kids at the middle class school were saying to some degree.
Sure, so there is some variation. But I guess, if I could rephrase the question then, right. So what I understand is, why is this a middle class, why are middle class students, or take the classroom, or the course you're writing for, like, why is it a middle class, what is it, like, if you didn't go into the school and you had an advanced hypothesis, right. You know, what would be the middle class approach to teaching, having students write the board, versus the working class approach? You know, why would we expect to find this, given the broader life experience, the habitus, if you will, whatever you want to call it, of the two different class positions?
Right.
You know, what's the sort of role the class plays as opposed to these just two different schools? I mean, yes, I buy that these are,
right.
You characterize the schools in this way, but I'm looking for more of an explanation of how does class impact.
And I'm not quite sure because it looks so different than what we expect, right? That these are kind of like emerging sense of identities that people didn't necessarily want to acknowledge in the past. Like, during the Soviets, everyone was equal, even if they weren't equal. Like, there was this ideology, even at the middle-class school, of like, we're all the same, don't highlight this difference. Don't highlight that your family now has more money, or that you can do things that others in the class can't do. So that was still, like, a local sort of notion of these emerging possible identities and what that looks like. Right? And not understanding, how do we deal with, is this something we want? Is this something we don't want? Right? So, I mean, again, like the terms I'm using here, I don't want to necessarily draw upon our Western views of these, but at some level we got to talk about it. So, go ahead. You're the demographer, right? It's understandable.
But that's sort of counterintuitive. So, you think the traditional middle class culture is more individualistic, there's a cult of individual achievement. And individual
but not necessarily in the Slavic area. I mean, this is the thing. This is a cultural thing. I can't recall who said it, but a recent scholar at in Kiev wrote a blog on this, saying that when you break down on surveys in terms of Ukrainians and where they lie, they have this strong feeling of sort of individual right to be able to write to determine things for myself, but a collective responsibility and obligation. And that seems very counterintuitive and seemed to conflict in terms of our models of how things work in society. So even with us, those middle class kids, there's this responsibility. My responsibility is because I have fun, because I have the opportunities other people don't have, because I have expectations that go with that. They're actually they're like the ones who see themselves as protectors of their culture and their language. They're the ones with the freedom to be able to do that. They can think about these things, and the working class people, they've got other things to do. And historically in Lviv, that's what held on. This is the story that they tell us, is the reason why Ukraine has their independent state, why the language still exists, is because you had a group of intellectuals, right, who promoted it and held on to it and kept it going. Yeah, go ahead.
Just somewhat related to that question, I wonder, and this question invites some speculation, so approach it as you wish, but do you think that in any way adopting this Taras Shevchenko type approach.
Mm-hmm. And these are all pseudonyms, right?
Sure.
Okay, good.
At an Ivan Franko type school would have these efficacious effects on the working class students? Or is the problem more deep-rooted in economic class itself?
Let me see. So if we had a teacher who did things like Mrs. Studnick did at Ivana Frankov, we'd have...
In a more working class school, would that make that group of working class students more upbeat about their identity as a globetrotter, mm-hmm. I think you phrase it, as opposed to the migrant or whatnot?
I'm not sure, because there's such a deep-seated stigma to a lot of these dialects. Part of it is because in history of Ukraine, right, the big thing is outside of Lviv, most people who spoke Ukrainian were villagers. So the heart of Ukrainian nation is both rural and rural lifeways and rural respect and rural helping everybody out and rural sort of being true people, but it's also the language is rural. So in trying to claim to be, we have the right to self-determination, we have the right to be our own country, now we have to work to say, how do we give power to this rural language? And so in doing that, one of the girls actually laid out, one of the ones who were very articulate, said, we can't have all these dialects because some people already think our language is a dialect. So for it to be a real language, we can't have all of these dialects going around, right? For her, standardization is the way to give Ukrainian, to make Ukrainian language of power, on par with Russian, on par with German, on par with English, right? That it has this kind of problem that needs to be solved. Where for the working class kids, that's not the case. They know people who speak like this all the time. It has color, it has flavor to it. It marks you as being from a particular kind of place. And the people who live there are not bad people, right? They're your family, they're your friends. They're people who are good-hearted people who will help you out no matter what you know, if you need something, right? People take care of each other in the village, right? This is not something we want to give up. Is that okay?
Yeah, I mean, I take away from that perhaps is the economic or rural.
Right, I think it's economic. I also think it's like this connection. Right, whether the rural is just some imagined place or whether the rural is a real place. Also in terms of like what you envision for the future. I had one working class girl who still has these strives for like this middle class sort of cosmopolitan sort of thing, because her family had, they hosted a guy from Texas at one point. They had family in France that they visit every 5 or 6 years whenever they could call enough money together to send a couple people there. So just those experiences helped her kind of raise a little bit in terms of what I can expect in my future and what I want out of my life that her classmates didn't necessarily have.
I really enjoyed the talk. I wanted to just ask about the distinction of the learning by living versus learning in a formal schooling setting. And the connection between that and ethnic identity in terms of shared common descent. Because I can see that distinction making a lot of sense in terms of mapping onto class differences. But wouldn't the working class people think of common descent also as a marker of Ukrainian identity? And so instead of just only speaking the language and having to live in a Ukrainian-speaking area, mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, why wouldn't they think of shared common descent as Ukrainian as being an important aspect of identity?
I'm trying to say, you're right.
your analysis is really focusing on mm-hmm. language as the basis for identity, mm-hmm. which I think is very interesting.
Right.
Makes sense in a lot of ways, but as opposed to language use and language knowledge, shared common descent is the main marker, main definition that people have of ethnicity, and that would be another way to understand who's Ukrainian and who's not. People looking at who their grandparents are, or et cetera.
Right.
So wouldn't ethnicity, does ethnicity come into...
Yeah, I actually think for both groups, ethnicity, when I asked them, like, what makes you Ukrainian, Ukrainian, right? They both told me language is something, being born in Ukraine. Right? And for them, that being born in Ukraine had, this is one of those interesting things there where you have this ethnicity and nation convolving on each other. They're kind of the same thing. It's hard to say the idea of like being an ethnic Ukrainian and not having that equal being part of the Ukrainian nation, right, doesn't seem to kind of mesh for them.
But a lot of Ukrainians in the diaspora would absolutely not agree that you have to be born in Ukraine to be part of it.
But that's the place where these kids would question whether diaspora are Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. Right? So for them, there's something about you can have your parents be there, but there's something you got to, like, there's this, when I asked them about it, most of what they were thinking were somebody who lives in Ukraine, being Ukrainian. You eat the food, you speak the language, you're born there. And when I asked them, can a Ukrainian be living someplace else? They were really stumped about how to think about that. Now, of course, these are like 8th and 9th graders, and when I go back there, I'm sure they'll have developed this a little bit more. But it's one of those things where, for the working class, it was sort of like, you have to find your place there. And when it came to talking about this connection and being sort of like a good patriot, being a good sort of member of the Ukrainian nation, was locating yourself here in a particular place. And I think that's the closest we can get to in terms of that ethnicity, because other types of differences get erased. I have a friend who, her name is Austrian, right? Her last name is Austrian. She does not think of herself as being Austrian in any way, right? She's like, but I'm Ukrainian, right? And so it's this difference of, they don't trace out that history. It's sort of like, well, I was born here and my parents were born here, right? So again, like that ethnicity, it comes out in terms of Russian, it comes out in terms of some of these other things that are mapped onto multiple. Like, I don't know if you would consider somebody ethnic Russian if they spoke Ukrainian and they were born in Ukraine. I don't know if they would identify and say, but you're Russian. The closest we find is like in other regions of the country, you have Russian speakers who say, I am Ukrainian. And then they're marking something that's like ethnic, but again, is it ethnic? Is it citizenship, right? What exactly is being talked about in terms of that? They don't necessarily use a term in terms of ethnic. I think it has this, you know, that Soviet past in terms of what you put on your passport is very changeable. I don't know if I,
So I ask this out of ignorance, but given Lviv's history, does Polish play a role in this? Is it the oppositional language that everyone can agree that, you know, we're not Polish, or how does that work?
It was really interesting actually asking them, because I thought that when I said, well, how well do you know Russian? How do you know it? Some of them had an easier time telling me that they had mutual comprehensibility. I can get by with it, or I should learn it more or something like that. When it came to Polish, I think that the alphabet itself was enough to throw them off. Even though they get Polish, they get a lot of Polish tourists in there. They have a lot of their pronunciations, because they're in Western Ukraine, are a little bit more similar to Polish. But I think that just having the writing look different, right, was something that they kind of turned in their head. I didn't necessarily see an opposition, though. When somebody said it was a Polish city, they were kind of like, well, I don't know about that, right? But on the other hand, that's where a lot of their tourists come from, so.
Well, they must also be able to get TV stations from Poland.
Yeah, I think most people said the weather. If you wanted to look for the weather channel, you wanted to see what it was in... Yeah, you wanted to see what it was in Poland, because it was more representative. And I actually... Yeah. But also in terms of, like, temperature-wise and that kind of thing. And the sense that I got for them was there wasn't this negativeness. If anything, people said, we hope we can be like Poland in 20 years. We hope, like, Poland is our future, right, in terms of the opportunities people have there, public transportation, all that other kind of thing was... you know, hopefully we can become like Poland, because right now we're like Poland was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
First a comment about the Polish thing. I also did my research and I just noticed a big difference between, like, when I asked, I also studied youth too, but like a little bit older, so like 18 to like 25. So actually probably like the same group, because you were like way before me, so we might have interviewed some of the same people. Anyway, and like I felt that like in the view when I asked people about language, way more people knew Polish than say like if you were in like Kiev or something. Mm-hmm. You know, so that like I do know a lot of people who not necessarily like formally studied Polish like in school, but definitely just sort of picked it up. Or you know, from watching TV or listening to Polish music, or like maybe they have family in Poland. But there's a really big difference. Like when I interview people in the capital, I don't think anybody ever said that they spoke Polish or knew Polish. Whereas like in the view, it was much more common. So that's just sort of my impression for that. But I had a question. In thinking about, so I would say since I've been going to Ukraine in 2008, I mean to Lviv specifically, there's been such an increase. There's such a difference, so many differences, you know, in the city. In terms of like when you ask people like sort of how is like Lviv developing economically, people always talk about IT jobs and tourism, right? And both of those jobs involved, for the most part, speaking another language. So I'm just curious, like, how you see that influencing possibly, like, people's choices in school, because, you know, people kind of see that now as opportunities for employment. Mm-hmm. You know, that they can work in IT or they can work in some sort of like tourism industry. So do you feel like that might have an influence then on sort of people's attitudes, mm-hmm. class, you know, middle class or lower working class, you know, in terms of?
That's definitely something that I wanted to look into this summer, especially because they've got a much better sense of like what they can do. And I'm actually wondering how much that might have, not just like in terms of like Euro 2012 and all of the influx and probably a lot of jobs during that time in which, wait a second, if I know English or something like that, I can get the job. So that's definitely something I wanted to look into, especially too in terms of like the economic, the big economic crisis happened like right after I left. And so how many of those that saw Europe as being kind of the future came back home again, right? Because of the failing economies in Europe. And that's something I want to get to, definitely. Because I think that probably would flip it around, especially if they see that I don't necessarily need to have a college education or a college degree in a particular field to do that, if I know the language.
Yeah, and so then it's more like you're not going abroad to use mm-hmm. those languages. It's like using those languages and staying in Ukraine, you know, for
right.
working classes.
Right, rather than the typical thing of you're in the stall, you're at the tourist, you know, you're trying to sell little tchotchkes or something like that to tourists someplace else, you know.
You mentioned the working class kids going to spend the summer at the dacha with grandma. Mm-hmm. Did the middle class kids do that? Did they identify with relatives? Did they talk about rural life?
Well, for the most part, the kids that were at this like middle class school, they had lived in the city for a couple generations, their families.
And their families, grandma, everybody, the whole.
So one of them was like, hey, my grandma was born here, right? And so part of it, I think, is maybe them being more established from having like somebody else had to move from the village to come here to work to get the education, maybe to sort of move us up or something else. Or I have a feeling that the part of the city I did my research in, they might have also been like the descendants of some of these intellectuals who had been in the city for a while. So when I talked to them in terms of the village, most of them said, if I have to go there, I don't want to.
So there's no dacha ownership, there's no tradition of like as is common in Moscow, for example.
Right.
Buying property.
Well, there was a little bit of idea in terms of like if it's a vacation home, mm-hmm. but really for them, the village was like, that's where poor people are, it's wow. really depressing, those are either relatives that like they no longer have contact with, or it's been, one girl said, I know I have a village, it's somewhere, I don't know where it is. I think I've been there once,
and
right?
I don't really want to find out.
Right? Well, for her, it was like, I'm claiming that I do have roots in a village somewhere, and that's important. Mm-hmm. But where it is and how often I go is not important, right? And they framed it in terms of, like, the ones who actually had been there, they're like, I hate it, it's boring, you know, nothing, there's never anything to do, people are here depressing, there's no jobs, mm-hmm. right? Well, but I think that with the working class kids who had more of these ties, it was more positive experience. Mm-hmm. It was like, my parents always ask me where I'm going to go here. In the village, I have free reign, partly because everybody knows who I am, right? Or knows why I'm here, right? But then I don't have to tell people where I'm going and what I'm doing. There's more spaces to kind of like get lost, right?
Yeah,
and you don't necessarily, they saw it as not having the dangers of the city.
And I have a question about the official picture in school of what mm-hmm. what Ukraine is and linguistic diversity in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Was there any conscious discussion in the school of what languages are spoken in Ukraine, of the fact that there are speakers of different languages, Ukrainian, Polish, Rusyn, is it called, in the western mm-hmm. part of Ukraine? Was there any conscious discussion of that?
Well, they're at the secondary school, their classes were taking like maybe 15 or 16 lessons in different subjects all the time. So I was actually amazed at how much they had learned up until like 8th and 9th graders saying, we know what slang is. We know that there are other dialects other places. In terms of the variety, I don't know, but at the college level, they know that there are some of these linguistic varieties. And recently when I was there doing these interviews, they had tried to pass a law that required Ukrainian as the language of instruction in all the colleges. And one of the middle class girls saw this as an improvement. She said that people are interested in learning Ukrainian. People who are not Ukrainian speakers are interested. See, even younger people in other regions of Ukraine are learning the language. Now, whether that was something that was seen to be enforced upon them, things that are going to actually make them perform worse at college because they didn't have Ukrainian before that, all that stuff didn't come into the picture. But she's also one, too, where she had the idea that, like, well, when I went to Egypt, right, knowing about class, right, when I went to Egypt, there were people who were very interested in learning Ukrainian. how she got that, but anyways, in her sense, it could have been a Ukrainian migrant who was working at the place that she was vacationing,
yeah,
right? Or somebody who chatted and said, hey, I just want to learn how to say please, thank you, right? You never know. But in her mind, this was evidence of, like, Ukrainian becoming somewhat of a language of power, right? That was valuable for other non-Ukrainians to be learning. Just like me being there, they saw as like a benefit, see somebody who's not diaspora.
My call time, but I wonder, I know there's a population of African immigrants in Ukraine, so I wonder how that plays into your analysis of linguistic definition of ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And I just Googled this, there's a Congolese Ukrainian pop singer too.
Mm-hmm. There's several.
I'm assuming this, but you probably get people who wear different skin color but speak mm-hmm. perfect working class Ukrainian or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is that kind of makes them Ukrainian for mm-hmm. those kids. How does that play out in terms of defining, how do they interpret that?
I think it's really kind of complicated. I think that this is a place where they're not quite sure what to do with it because you have like Gorka Shelley, who are like half Turkish and half Ukrainian. They speak in Ukrainian. You have, I'm forgetting her name, the half African American Ukrainian. She's really big for a while. Like these popular artists in which in some ways they're saying this is a good thing, but they're not quite sure how to interpret it when they see the person on the street. So our shared instructor taught a lot of the international students from Southeast Asia, from Africa. Some of them had a Ukrainian parent, and so they could go to school there and have a passport. And the sense that I got there were people were really not sure how to deal with that. When you have somebody who visibly looks like you have a stereotype in your head, and they don't fit that stereotype, how to deal with this sort of mixedness. And we find that in Lviv. Definitely. You don't find the violence against them that you might find that I've heard in terms of Kiev, but you've got a guy from Africa who's half Ukrainian and he's wearing hip-hop clothes and has more money than locals, right? Coming to study at a university, you find people who are like, yay, you're exotic, you're great, this is where we should be going, and some that are just afraid and they don't know how to interpret, especially since it challenges their notion of where they sit in the world, right? In terms of we belong in the part of the first world. We belong part of the haves. We belong in Europe. And in a lot of ways, like, Africa is, like, the worst thing to be on par with Africa. But it doesn't necessarily break down all of that, because when I ask students in terms of, like, Japan's part of the first world for their mind. Right?
Was there at all a stigma against use of loan words? I know you mentioned that there was a big academic kind of revolution to revive Ukrainian. And I know that in Finland, there was a similar movement probably about 20 years ago where words were coming in from English, like computer, then just morphologically adjusted, like komputeri, and then like they came up with a new word, tietokone, which means think machine, literally from Finnish roots.
Right.
Is there any like academic resistance to loan words, particularly from Russian, English? Obviously Russian
right.
is kind of fuzzy, but
right.
From English or other?
Not that I know of, because I see a lot of words that get borrowed from like English and they just sort of pronounce it in
like
Ukrainian.
Latin words, right, where you just like
right.
add an English word and make it evocative.
But it looks different than like diaspora here and the things that they do with English.
Phonologically adjusted.
Right, right. I mean, they have computer. I mean, I've seen a lot where I'm like, I have to read it out, and I'm like, oh, okay, site, you know, like you're borrowing stuff. I think most of that happened earlier when they had a little bit more rights out of it in terms of, like, not using the thing that sounds more Russian. But even then, like, some of the kids, they're like, I'd rather curse in Russian than curse in Ukrainian. Because even cursing in Ukrainian admits that there are curse words in Ukrainian that you could use. Right. I mean, that's the level of the purity of some people, is denying that they actually have curse words.
Interesting.
I heard kids saying like chow all the time. Like they, it's not just English either. They'll pick up stuff from other places. And actually, the image that I had in there and first of like that pop group that I found, their name is taken. They took it from Spanish, right? So.
Oh, thank you. What about the immigrant populations that you're going to be interviewing in Chicago this summer? Are you hoping to isolate a group that's only from Western Ukraine, or will it be?
I want to look first all in the community, because I went there during a conference in the fall just for like a morning to make touch base with people, and I know that the older generations in the community that are active definitely like have views on like young people, whether they're still as active and committed, you know, to sort of their act in terms of Ukraine. Right now, I'm not sure. And part of me really would like to find this generation, those who are born in Ukraine no matter where, right, and who are born here. Because if they are having some participation within the community, that will tell me already like their level of activity and that they're thinking about some of these things. And for ethnography, it's hard. One of the troubles with ethnography is the fact that like people might say, why do you want to ask me about this? Because this doesn't matter to me. You know, so you kind of have to find people who it does matter to them. So I would love to find both, because I get a sense that like I'm not sure how much recent immigrants are being incorporated into the community for the first part, and whether their incorporation might challenge the existing notions of who we are as Ukrainian. You know, if you have a vision of Ukraine that's a couple generations old, right, then maybe recent immigrants, you know. And I actually talked with Areta. I talked with a Ukrainian diaspora who's from Chicago, who's now living in Lviv, and I asked her in terms of like that transition. She's like, growing up, I never really had any interactions with anybody who from Ukraine, and then moving to Lviv and all the things she's had to sort of adapt to that are different than she didn't necessarily expect.
And I just like heard from like diaspora in like Cleveland, for instance, that there is a difference between sort of the Ukrainian, you know, the kids who grew up in Cleveland, who were born in Cleveland, and recent immigrants, that like there is sort of this like very noticeable division. So I mean, that might be something that's like particular to that Catholic region, but I definitely think that would be a super interesting question to look at, because I've heard about it in other places. People do make this kind of, you know, they have this marker of like, oh, so you're from Ukraine, and that's different from like being Ukrainian American.
Right, and I actually think that some immigration literature, I have a feeling, has that. It's not necessarily a unique thing. I mean, I had a student in San Diego who was a recent immigrant from China, and she said, I get along way better with the Mexican Americans. The Chinese Americans in Southern California, I don't get them. So.
But I know somebody you can talk to.
Okay, good. I'll have to talk to you afterwards.
Can I ask one more question about the age factor?
Yeah.
Just listening to you, some of your answers. I mean, as your presentation was going on, I sort of forgot, as you said, 8th and 9th graders. But I'm just wondering how you think of that age of respondents and their self-understanding of anything.
It's better than you would think.
I just wonder if there isn't. I mean, how do you connect that to, like, I mean, you're making a claim about classes, but then people you're asking are maybe people, like, when does somebody become a member of the working class? Like, presumably at age 4, I don't know, are there class, I mean, when do you get the class differences? Mm-hmm. When do you get a self-articulation of class differences? Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how you...
Well, I think for me it goes back to this question of, like, how to even talk about class, and I'm using these terms in terms of... I don't even know if you talk to people now if they would be aware of these identities in terms of class, but at least recognizing that there are differences and that some of these differences give certain, I mean, all of the kids in these classes, all at both schools, you have people of middle class and working class. One just has more predominantly working class, one has more predominantly middle class. But the ideologies that they're learning that they attribute is that our friends are across these classes. Working class kid is friends with a middle class kid. But what their family can do, what you can do, right, what kinds of gifts you can exchange with student, like with each other during the holidays, some of these things came up a little bit more in terms of fissures when people were sort of seen to be showing elements of class that were problematic. So partly is I'm looking at them not at necessarily all at developmental stage, except I think that at that age, they're thinking for themselves, but they still are influenced by these other forces. And so we can kind of see a mapping of what they're learning on top of how they're trying to make sense of it. And I think that they were very much aware of some of these differences, you know, in terms of who gets to have like the Nike brand hat that is super expensive, right? And wear that as part of their everyday clothing at work. And I get the feeling when I went back to see them in the this summer, some of the friendships remained, and the ones that remained were ended up kind of being from the same class. Like the connections that were sort of cross class, sort of falling apart or falling by the wayside.
So could you talk about the Odessa Living Dolls?
I gave a paper in the fall. I'm not sure when I'm gonna end up coming out with it, but I was talking about the Odessa Living Dolls. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them at all. They're these women. There's actually only three of them, and yet they've had a lot of exposure, who are trying to stylize themselves as a reflection of their ideal beauty, but as a beauty that the outside I want to match my inside. So inside, I am beautiful, I am moral, and I'm trying to transform the outside of me too. Most of Western media looks at them as freaks. What they're doing is extreme cosmetic surgery. They're doing all of these things that turn them into not human anymore in a lot of ways. And some of their ideologies too, in terms of putting on seminars for astroplane projection, these types of things fold up into this Western sort of like the freak show, right, that we all want to kind of make sense of. And so in the paper, we're going to see how it works out. I'm sort of critiquing a little bit of the media and saying we have to make sense of how gender is expressed in the history of these gender relations in Eastern Europe to see that actually this cultivation of beauty as a reflection of a moral person is actually pretty Slavic. You see a lot of women, even my friend who works in Odessa, right, where girls will dress to the nine to go out places, right? And that in a way what they're doing actually is reinforcing things like the gender norms. One woman says, like, my husband pays for all of this, even though you know she's making a lot of money on these seminars and other things. But she says, it's something my husband, this is something I do for myself, and my husband supports it. Even though the media tries to say she's sexualized, right, she's selling herself, she doesn't have a good sort of moral center, she's confused, she's a danger to young women who want to emulate her, right, instead of seeing it as maybe a way to be pretty, but also a way to be a businesswoman and not be demonized, right, as interacting with Western capital. But that somehow I can kind of put these things a little bit together.
So is Femin in part reacting against them?
That's a good question. Femin is definitely much more political. Dolls would claim no political nothing, right? They're spiritual. They're trying to, you know, help everybody else figure out how to cultivate your, you know, your inner beauty, get you to achieve that kind of thing. Femin, I don't know, but it definitely is an alternate kind of femininity.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely, in terms of putting the body on display as a
weapon.
Yeah, definitely. Which is a whole other kind of thing. But at least there are these avenues for alternate femininities where a lot of the literature in post-Soviet and gender saw when independence came, all of those all that sort of progress during the Soviet system got thrown out, and people sort of came back to paternalistic, came back to like women should be in the home, you know, you shouldn't necessarily be working kind of thing. So at least here we have another alternative kind of femininity.
Great. All right, well, thanks everybody, and thank you.